Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Over time, over 5 to 10 years, 15 years, having some awareness of how well we are doing at climate mitigation will matter if we want to start after it becomes an issue. Good luck to us. I mean, we could start now, right?
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm William Lieben, a researcher in the policy engagement team here at the National Security College. Today's podcast has been recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we pay respects to their elders past and present. Today I'm joined by Dr. James Mortensen and Isabel Bond. Dr. James Mortensen is a lecturer at the National Security College with research interests including environmental security and climate change. And Isabel Bond has a bachelor's degree in marine and Antarctic governance and is a research assistant here at the NSC. Welcome, James and Isabel.
Thanks.
Thanks, Will.
So we're here to discuss polar geopolitics as well as a recent policy options paper that you both co-authored published by the NSC entitled Cold Logic, Getting Intelligent About Antarctica. And I should note that, of course, any views expressed today are in a personal capacity only and don't represent those of any Australian government organisation. So with that housekeeping aside, perhaps we might start with the broad context for the research you've conducted in this area, which strikes me as twofold, that being climate change and Australia's stake in the Antarctic Treaty System. Isabel, perhaps you might set the scene for listeners who might not be familiar with the details of Antarctic governance and Australia's role in the system.
Yeah, so very briefly, the governance system in Antarctica is primarily governed by the Antarctic Treaty, which was signed in 1961, and it demilitarises the continent, and it's a system built on peace and science. The Antarctic Treaty, there's also a system, so it's not just a treaty itself, but there's subsequent international agreements which seek to, for example, protect the environment and prohibit mining and manage the marine living resources down there. And Australia claims 42% of the continent, and so there's various claims to Antarctica. These claims overlap and they're not kind of set in stone. The sovereignty is frozen. There's a sovereignty freezing mechanism under the Antarctic Treaty System. Any states can conduct science down there as long as they can access to the continent. So there's a lot of different states involved down in Antarctica.
Nice. So perhaps, James, if you could expand a little and talk to Australia's strategic interests in Antarctica, because I think it's a geography that a lot of listeners will be familiar with thinking about in perhaps niche terms and not perhaps within the frame of reference of Australian strategic policy.
Well, I mean, I think the big issue and really what our paper is trying to speak to is that there's sort of two answers to that question, and there may be there needs to be an alternative. So, I mean, one answer to the question is our wider strategic interest in Antarctica is, of course, upholding the win-win of cooperation, scientific cooperation, hand-holding and general good times down in Antarctica, building the world we want to see on the international stage. On the flip side, and certainly the thing that I think is getting a lot more traction in national security circles or general strategic circles for the last decade or so is the same thing, but from a negative perspective, hedging geopolitical competition. So especially with that country that shall not be named, the degree to which we might see exploitation of resources, whether that's maritime resources, fish stocks, oil, or moving to mineral wealth, etc. The degree to which Other states might seek to militarize Antarctica, disrespect the treaty system, and generally take advantage of that sort of cooperation. There are other, maybe more niche issues. Probably monitoring is the biggest one that comes to mind. So having satellite or comms monitoring down on the pole is good, especially if, say, you're a Northern Hemisphere power that doesn't necessarily have access to that territory. And lastly, I suppose keeping spheres of influence open, given the air of cooperation. Antarctic research is niche but very important and not at all cheap. So having a foothold down there is obviously could be of use and create important inroads. Those are the sorts of strategic considerations that I think most people have had and largely gets the sort of conversation going or has got the conversation going. Though the degree to which those two things or those two aspects should be all we talk about, I mean, that's sort of the question that we've raised in the paper.
I think we'll come back to the geopolitics of the current moment in Antarctica and how these issues are intertwined. But I think first it might be useful to pull a little further on the thread about climate science in Antarctic and the role that Antarctic research plays from an Australian point of view and also as part of the global science enterprise on climate change. For instance, there was a line that stuck out to me in the paper that perhaps might surprise some readers as well, where you note that more research is actually required to still improve climate model projections. Of course, we've just seen the release of the IPCC's sixth synthesis report. We know that climate science has developed a more and more mature and high fidelity understanding of how the Earth system is changing. What role, I should say, does Antarctica play in developing that science, and why is it particularly important?
Well, to understand how important climate science is, one has to understand, Antarctica for climate science, one has to understand Antarctica's role on the climate system in general. And so Antarctica is a pivotal regulator of the Earth's global climate system. And this is for numerous reasons. For example, it regulates incoming solar radiation. It also initiates deep ocean currents, which distribute heat around the globe. And it's an important carbon sink as a result of biophysical processes. And so although a lot of these processes are relatively well understood, there are many which aren't. For example, sea ice and ice sheet dynamics. And these are interconnected and interdependent with the processes just mentioned. And so the uncertainty surrounding those is a major impediment to the betterment of global climate models, considering that Antarctica can be likened to the Earth's global climate system's engine on Earth. So the fact that we don't know, there are still uncertainties within this, what we know about this engine means that our understanding of global climate models isn't as complete or as accurate or as precise as it could be. And this has been kind of highlighted again to us, considering, in March 2022, two ice shelves the size of Sydney broke off. And importantly, this breaking off of ice shelves was unexpected and unpredicted. So, and is also similar to what we saw previously this century in the Larsen B ice shelf breaking off Antarctica as well. So that was also an unexpected ice sheet collapse.
We know that what happens in Antarctica has a huge impact on what happens everywhere else in the world. We just don't necessarily know how much and when it will manifest and that sort of thing. And given the rising importance of, especially severe weather events in Australia, an extra week of warning. Imagine an extra week of warning on the last, flood, bushfire, whatever. It's a huge value proposition from a human cost and a financial cost. So the more we can understand it, the better.
Yeah, I think it's a useful point to draw out, among other things, because perhaps the persistent patter of news, be it day-to-day or scientific reporting pulled into mainstream news reporting, might give the impression that we understand everything as well as we need to and that the status quo is adequately developed, and that's obviously not the case. We're in a position where we can absolutely make decisions and implement policy and so on, but the frontier is obviously continuously developing, as you both well appreciate, and people who are listening and keyed into this science or this policy area will know as well. And then another example in only the last week or so that I imagine both of you would have seen reporting in Nature Climate Change on melting of Antarctic ice and its role in disrupting effectively global ocean circulation as a key driver in turn of the Earth system as a whole. So this stuff is just really critical and our understanding is developing all the time.
Can I say that there's that immediate stuff? There's also just like basic longitudinal studies that are still developing. So in the, I think the Morrison government's big announcement, the 880-something million-dollar investment in Antarctic stuff. One of the major, you know, crown jewels in that announcement was getting an ice core. So driving, and it's not easy to say get an ice core, but you've got to drive what, 1,300 kilometres in minus 40.
And a million-year ice core.
Yeah, yep. To get an ice core that goes back a million years, right? Now, that's all cool and sexy, and we can look at that and say, oh, well, you know, that's a good win. But the fact is, like, we need that ice core because we only have, I think there's only one other million year ice core that, like, the British Antarctic guys pulled up. And, you know, one's a great start, but, you know, you need to compare it. So even on this really broad longitudinal stuff, like, what has the climate looked like for the past last million years? I mean, the cost is large, and we are still doing it, right? Like it's still evolving rather than sort of locked in, and we can take it for granted.
We'll be right back.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
So perhaps this might be a useful juncture for us to tack back towards the more overt geopolitics side of the conversation. And while you obviously didn't plan to write and release the policy paper at this point in time, you know, it's also been fortuitous, the news cycle over the last week or so in terms of geopolitical developments. So, for instance, Center for Strategic and Independent Studies out of the US this week published a report picking apart developments in China's construction of its fifth research station down in Antarctica. And of course, to be absolutely clear, this is a routine development. This is not new news. As we've opened with, the Antarctic Treaty System has a large number of claimants and scientific stakeholders down on Antarctica. So we need to discuss this in context, but for understandable reasons, this is getting quite a bit of, attention in the more mainstream media, shall we say. How do you see the significance of those kind of developments within both Antarctica and within Australia's broader strategic concerns?
The difficulty, I think, is that it's the nature of Antarctica itself, not ever having been, but trying to get my head around. Like I said, trying to get this ice core, right? Like traveling 1,300 kilometres is hard work, whether it's, you know, it's between Sydney and Brisbane or Casey Station in the South Pole. That's fine. But it's obviously much harder work down there, right? Like infinitely harder work. And we're talking like $160 million maybe might get us there one way, you know? I don't know. Don't quote me on the figure, but it's obviously millions of dollars. It's a lot of work. And so when we're talking about, say, a nation building a base in Antarctica, you know, one might, it would be understandable to forget the fact that in order to actually check what's going on down there, like you're waiting till summer, you're chartering a cold weather, you know, aircraft that's capable of making the flight, you're putting together the team, you're turning up, you've got like half a day to walk around and say hi. And, you know, maybe we do this. Our inspection schedule, I think, is getting increased as part of, again, as part of the investment down there. It's not the sort of thing that you can – there's a lot of guesswork involved is, what I suppose, what I'm saying. If we know that they're building the base, great. What does it actually look like? What's actually going on? Well, you're going to at least spend 11 months of the year wondering. I don't know, to get it maybe glib, when it comes to security policy and security concerns, I think, you know, wondering is the best place to start and the worst place to finish. That tempers a lot of my sort of expectations, I suppose, on that sort of stuff. The question, I suppose, of, well, should we be concerned? Evidently, the wider political climate, no pun intended, is certainly such that obviously casting an eye and having some concern is fine. Ramifications for Antarctica, though, I think in a way it's much more responsible to wait and see. It's much more responsible to wait until we can get on the plane and have a look and have a walk around and shake hands. And that I think is crucial to the sort of treaty system success overall. I don't know if you would say the same.
Yeah, collaboration and, working together. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if that makes sense, you know, like as in, yeah, CSIS, we want to, yeah, sure, it's our job to worry, right? But at the same time, that worry should only go as far as, well, someone's actually going to go on the plane and they're actually going to have a look. And maintaining that cooperation and camaraderie is absolutely crucial to the treaty.
Yeah. So two things that really stick out at me in your comments just then that might be worth highlighting for people. The first is, the sheer difficulty of doing anything in this environment. Some people will be aware of the fact that Australia had plans to establish effectively a year-round airfield capability near one of its research stations. The then government abandoned those plans in late 2021 for, I think, a complicated set of reasons, I imagine many of which are not necessarily public, but among them the extraordinary cost of that endeavour to establish something that is actually operable year-round in such a hostile environment. So to accomplish anything, let alone anything at scale, is incredibly difficult. And the second is how we know things about what other countries are doing in Antarctica, and what people for the most part wouldn't be aware of, I'm sure, is that it's actually through inspection. So even in the CSIS work, for instance, it does use imagery analysis to a certain extent, but largely it draws on work or information gathered through compliance inspections that are conducted under the Antarctic Treaty System by all the partner countries involved. So both the United States and Australia in 2020 conducted extensive inspection tours of other parties' research stations. This is, yes, to verify the demilitarized status of those facilities, but also very much to ensure the more mundane but critically important things like environmental compliance, down to the minutiae of, do you have spill kits next to your generators? Are you protecting the environment? Are you preserving Antarctica for those values as well? And that really speaks to and underlines, I think, how this system functions. And at this point in time, despite, as you say, arguably necessary worry and attention onto the political possibilities in this space, that the system is cooperative and it's built on a certain degree of openness and cooperation, partly also because of the sheer hostility of the environment.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like it's, that we want to worry, absolutely. But ultimately that worry cannot and should not extend further than what the inspection teams, especially now that we're instituting, as far as I'm aware, a raised inspection schedule. Like they need to be able to breathe easy and tell tell the story that they see, and we need to take that, I think. And especially, as you said, yeah, routine, right? Like your spill kits next to your generators, what do you do with your rubbish? What do you do with your muesli bar wrapper? Like, this is the sort of minutiae that they need to do. And in such a harsh environment, you know, like, I think a lot of people would just be hard pressed getting two things done. The other thing that I want to say, based on, yeah, what you've put forward, Will, like, with the I think it was off Casey base, the decision to not go ahead with the airfield, it's drawn some criticism, it's drawn some praise for a variety of different reasons. And one of the threads that goes through that that decision, as well as other decisions that have been made recently, is the notion of dual use and demilitarization. You know, an all-weather airfield might make it easier to do inspections. It would also make it easier to host military aircraft and that sort of thing. There have been other decisions that Australia's made recently with their Antarctic budget, like the drones, right? So an increased drone fleet and that sort of stuff, which, again, in theory will help inspections, but also could be seen as that sort of stuff. It seems like a bit of a wicked game, ultimately, that we can't necessarily get away from. But in my mind, that doubles down on the fact that we need to trust the inspections more than we trust our worries, I suppose.
So a question for you both now. Obviously, without divulging any confidences, I imagine you spoke to a variety of counterparts, both in the research community and in government, in the course of doing this work. Might you offer some comment on how counterparts in government or different colleagues understand the problem, where they share how you framed the problem and what their thinking is in terms of the policy avenues forward?
Well, I think a lot of the focus in government at the moment seems to be on the more tactical kind of short-term focus of climate science and climate change in particular, rather than that strategic kind of longer-term, that longer-term focus, which is more of the emphasis of our papers, like kind of looking broader and looking at the strategic kind of ramifications of this kind of thing. But what do you think, James?
I think that there's a particular reason that if you do read the paper, I strongly suggest you read the paper. Feel free to send us any comments. That there's a reason that the paper is framed for what it means for Australia domestically, rather than what it means internationally. There are international ramifications for taking a more, in our view, responsible, not slinging any mud, but a more responsible view of what the strategic value of Antarctica is. Pitching that domestically, because, you know, the language of weather, right, weather with an EA, the language of weather is in ascendancy in Australia, in political circles, in policy circles, as it probably is long overdue. So, you know, in that sense, I think it's that maybe is an answer to your question. It gives you a feel for, I suppose, the traction involved in saying, well, look, I know, you know, you might see that Antarctica is the purview of, well, the guys that like Antarctica and the dual use stuff and sure, right? But if you want our climate capabilities, our ability to see ahead or project forward or to understand more robustly what effects and detriments and thing, what's coming over the horizon climate-wise, if that is crucial to us, and which it is from a domestic point of view, then, you know, the southern continent's got a lot more value to you than warm and fuzzy feelings or dual-use technology. You know? So, and that seems to be, it seems to have hit a nerve in a good way, I hope.
It might be worth pointing out for people as well just how small an area of government and responsibility in sheer human terms this is when we're talking about actually doing things in Antarctica and even the scientific endeavour. For understandable reasons, this is an area of our machinery of government that most people won't be intimately familiar with, but the Australian Antarctic Division, I should say, for our listeners, is part of DQ, what is now the Department of Climate Change, the Environment, Energy and Water. I think I'm getting that right. One of our favourite acronyms. I'm sure we'll get corrections if I was wrong. But this is, in the scale of government and certainly in terms of broader foreign policy conversations, a very small part of government, which has a focus on enabling scientific endeavour for good reason. So we're talking about quite a small number of genuine experts in the field, let alone people with field experience down in the environment. alongside a community of researchers who understand the scientific problems, which I think is just useful to point out because it kind of is important to colour how we think about actually getting anything done in this environment and who understands the problem. It's quite different to most of the conversations we have, certainly in National Security College, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, you're feeling on this as well, but like it seemed to me, I want to say fair, seems to us, but I'd love verbal confirmation from you. I don't want to speak for you. That, you know, as a, up until this point, and one of the main sort of drivers for us to write this paper was that small group of people, the AAD, the people in the Australian Antarctic Program, they know that it's important, it's their life, that's what they do. And then from other areas, we interact with Antarctica along those sort of geopolitical lines that we first started talking about, right? As in, we want to make sure that we're all cooperating. We want to make sure that no one comes in and spoils the party and takes advantage of the minerals or whatever else. You know, Antarctica is basically a source of concern, right? Rather than this is a place where if we invest, we will see dividends for our wider security, not simply hedging people in Antarctica, but as in maintaining the Australian, you know, polity way of life in a positive sense. You know, we hope that changing the conversation in this way will mean that small arm of government, as you said, yeah, and I think it's like 400 people or something, the AAD is about 400 strong, that if it stays 400 strong, they at least get a lot more support and a lot more help to do work that ultimately, whether we realise it or not, will be critical to Australia and indeed the rest of the world moving forward.
I think this brings us pretty squarely and usefully onto, I guess, the meat of the paper, which is, to put it in plain language, well, what do we do about it? What are the next steps? So perhaps, Isabel, if you could speak to the recommendations and give us a summary of what you think the most valuable steps for the Australian government to take are in this area at the moment.
So before we kind of get into the recommendations, we might need to contextualise a little bit more about what we're talking about in the paper when we're referring to climate intelligence. And this is kind of takes two forms. We're talking about intelligence for Antarctica, in which case we're talking about how climate changes in Antarctica are likely to affect Australia's Antarctic interests, so how climate science can be used to help us kind of gain an understanding and more foresight in relation to that, and also in relation to intelligence from Antarctica, so how the science collected down there will potentially be able to help security agencies preempt the ramifications of climate changes on Australia and in our broader region and neighbourhood. So a few examples of this include, you know, obviously for disaster preparation and humanitarian assistance, strategic planning, and also it has diplomatic benefits as well. So following on from this, our first recommendation is that a climate intelligence working group be established with different members from the intelligence community and the scientific community, including those such as the Bureau of Meteorology, CSIRO, the Australian Antarctic Division, the Office of National Intelligence, the Defence Intelligence Organisation, and various others. And that this intelligence working group report its findings to the National Security Committee of Cabinet or the Secretary's Committee of National Security, and recommend priority areas of scientific study. So that goes to our second recommendation, which is that these priority areas should be supported by increased funding and capability, and that the amount and delivery of this would fall upon the member agencies, and that this funding could be drawn from existing departmental allocations.
I mean, I think in the paper we put it in really cold, hard terms, right? Australia spends about $38 billion a year in natural disaster mitigation. That's a big number. And projections suggest that will start to rival, say, things like the defence budget in a matter of a decade. Right? So the more that we can acknowledge, plan for, prepare and mitigate natural disasters, you know, when we're talking about an Antarctic budget that's $880 million over 20 years, like it's a pittance.
Yeah, thanks. It occurs to me as well that for some people, the idea that, you know, climate science is intelligence might sound provocative. I think it's worth also pointing out that in a way there has already been de facto acknowledgement of that equivalence. The new Labor government, when it came into office, one of its first sort of acts in the national security space was to order the Office of National Intelligence to conduct a a climate change and security risk assessment, which was done. That wasn't focused on Antarctica, but merely in ordering that work and ONI carrying it out, clearly there is an understanding from the people who understand the threats and the risks and how we need to understand our regional environment that whether or not we're choosing to use the direct language of equivalence between climate science and intelligence, the equivalence is there. So the idea that this is provocative or entirely novel, I don't think is something that either of you would claim, but anybody who would have that reaction, I think that they would be misplaced in having that reaction.
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, there's also, there's a matter of just being ahead of the curve. Like I think the climate, no pun intended, globally, geopolitically is changing adherence or hopeful adherence to 1.5 degrees. Warming is will matter. Emissions will matter. And over time, over 5 to 10 years, 15 years, having some awareness of how well we are doing at climate mitigation will matter if we want to start after it becomes an issue. Good luck to us. I mean, we could start now, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that a recent report released by the UN has actually said that there's no realistic way in which we can keep to at 1.5 degrees. So we're looking at above that.
Everything's going to matter. Little detail will matter. And, you know, Australia is claiming 42% of the continent. Mm-hmm. We like to think of ourselves as an Antarctic leader. Mm-hmm. Actually, evidence suggests that is actually the case. Well, let's do it. Because this information on multiple levels, whether it's climate mitigation and making sure that we are doing the most that we can, which I believe will be very important and pertinent information to many people around the world moving forward, or whether it's if we can sort of crack the code, and we should be clear, I don't think we are suggesting at all that more money equals more science. That's not how science works, but certainly more money helps the chance of more science. And if we can, you know, make some good headway to really understand, you know, El Nino Southern Oscillation, all of these sorts of things, climate drivers that affect countries on a yearly basis, you know, that is valuable information to us. It's valuable information to, I don't know, Bangladesh, name a country, right? This stuff has a value and it will have a more powerful value every year that passes from here. Getting on now is better than getting on when it's, you know, Too late. Well, it's already too late. Don't tell the kids.
So I think that leads us quite nicely to my last question, which pulls on another thread within your paper, which is this distinction you draw between, I think the language you use is a positive vision of security within the Antarctic Treaty system, and perhaps a more traditional or familiar approach in other areas of our foreign policy or defence policy, which might simply be about minimising conflict risks. So if you could speak a little to that distinction and I guess its implications for kind of the vision implicit in the paper.
So, yeah, what we talk about in the paper is that there's these positive security benefits that can be realised through increasing climate science and understanding Antarctica more, and that these security benefits are real and that, you know, hedging it against other kind of potential conflict is also important, but that this is an area that could be increased and hasn't been recognised as much as for its security benefit as it could be.
So we're really talking about opportunities rather than just risks, to use that alternate language, I suppose, Jane.
I'd say absolutely. Yeah. We want to, like, Antarctica. I think we've backed ourselves into a little bit of a corner. We say, well, what if someone took advantage of it? We need to make sure that no one else takes advantage of it, right? And there's cooperation down there with science, and that's nice. But it's scientific. It's science for scientists, and that's a positive outcome for the scientists. And we just need to make sure that nobody, you know, rips the guts out of the place or puts a bomber down there or something, right? As opposed to saying, well, you know, actually the science that goes on down there, it helps the Australian security environment immensely. It helps us mitigate, or could hopefully help us, you know, mitigate the worst of or prepare for climate impacts, maintain as much as we possibly can monitoring of, you know, emissions and our targets for making sure the world doesn't catch on fire in 100 years. These are positive security realizations, And concentrating on those, I think, is, you know.
I think that's a nice, mildly optimistic note to end what is often a pretty bleak topic. Thank you both for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.